Here, the title of this story, The Cleansing of the Temple, is an inaccurate and misleading name for Mark's story in terms of what it actually reports. The emphasis is not on the cleansing of the temple, that is, of its purification from being turned into a marketplace and a place of corruption by the chief priests, which is implied in the title, The Cleansing of the Temple. Rather, this is a story about the prophetic proclamation of the perversion of the purpose of the temple that had happened in the first century. What happens in this story is that Jesus does indeed make a prophetic demonstration of turning over the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who were selling pigeons and so on. But the purpose of that is to make the court of the Gentiles in the Jerusalem temple a place of prayer rather than a place of commerce for Judeans. So this, what's going on, is much more involved with the politics of the first century and of relationships between Israel's people and her enemies. The temple area was about 35 acres, and most of that large area around a central court was called the Court of the Gentiles. It was a large area in which there were porticos, there were meeting rooms. One whole side of the Court of the Gentiles was a large building that had offices. That was the primary administrative center for the city of Jerusalem, as well as for the temple itself, which was a huge institution. Changing of money was because Israelites came from all over the world to Jerusalem. They brought with them their various currencies. And so rather than the temple administration taking on the task of all the changing of the money, they required that people make their contributions in temple currency. And so it needed then to be changed from whatever currency they brought to that currency in order for them to make their contributions and offerings to the temple. The same was true in relation to the marketing of doves and of other animals for the sacrifices. That was done and was located within the temple in order to make it convenient for people who were coming to get the animals that they were going to sacrifice on the altar in the main, on the high altar in the center of the temple. All of that, the money changing, the doves, the animals for the sacrifices, could have been done easily outside the temple. But this made it more convenient for Judeans, and in turn made it a place of that was not conducive to prayer. And so there were intense political issues around the role of the temple. The current controversies that are happening in that same area about the mosque, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and the Dome of the Rock, and of people coming to that and being forbidden to in any way indicate that they are praying, is interesting, because the controversies in the temple and in the temple area and its purpose continue now 2,000 years later. So the way in which the temple was constructed was that this large area of the court of the Gentiles surrounded a smaller area that was built, that was walled in, and Gentiles were not permitted to enter into what was called the court of the women. If they were caught inside the court of the women, they were to be immediately executed. And there were signs on the doors leading to the court of the women. And so Judeans would climb the steps that led to the court of the women, and then they would, and the women would stay there. Men would go through and go up another series of steps to the area where the great altar was in front of the temple itself, which was a relatively small building that only the priests could enter at the times of prayer, as reflected, for example, in the story of Zechariah at the beginning of Luke. So the background of this story, it's more appropriately called, I think, the demonstration in the temple than the cleansing of the temple. Now, some notes about learning this story. The story has three episodes, the demonstration, the teaching, and the responses. And the first has two sentences. The second also has two sentences, and the third has three. The first episode begins with the location of this, namely Jerusalem. It's a very short period, therefore slow, and it emphasizes Jerusalem. It is similar in its structure to the introduction to the story of Bartimaeus. And they came to Jericho. And that evokes all of the memories around Jericho and Joshua. Here it is, they came to Jerusalem, the city of David. All of the memories associated with Jerusalem are then brought to this story. And this is the first time in the story that Jesus has been in Jerusalem in the Gospel of Mark. The second period of this is a long period with three cola, each of which is relatively long. Entered the temple, began to drive out those who were selling and those who were buying in the temple, overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves, and he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. So it's a long description of the details of what Jesus did in this demonstration, and that goes fast and has the atmosphere and the character of a demonstration. The final conclusion of this is Jesus' teaching, which is the climax of this first episode. He was teaching and saying, "Is it not written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations,' but you have made it a den of insurrectionists"? Now, this episode of Jesus' teaching is the core of the story. And its meaning and impact is shaped by the allusions that Jesus is making in this first statement to the prophetic pronouncements of Isaiah and Jeremiah. So listen to Isaiah 56, 7, which is what Jesus is quoting here, or is alluding to. Do not let the foreigner, that is, the representative of the nations, the Gentile, joined to the Lord, say, the Lord will surely separate me from his people. And do not let the eunuch say, I'm just a dry tree. For thus says the Lord, to the eunuchs who keep my Sabbaths, who choose the things that please me and hold fast my covenant, I will give in my house and within my walls a monument and a name better than sons and daughters. I will give them an everlasting name that shall not be cut off. And the foreigners, translate the Gentiles, the representatives of the nations, who join themselves to the Lord, to minister to him, to love the name of the Lord, and to be his servants, all who keep the Sabbath and do not profane it, and hold fast my covenant, these I will bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices will be accepted on my altar, for my house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations. Now, this is an incredible prophecy in the context of the traditions of Israel. Nowhere else that I know of is there this radical declaration of God's acceptance of foreigners, that is, non-Israelites, into the temple. And it even extends to the acceptance of their offerings. The implication is that Isaiah foresaw a time when people who were loyal to the Lord, who kept the Sabbath, who observed the law, would be able to go through the court of the women to the high altar and have their sacrifices accepted and offered on the high altar in the temple. It also is a vision of the temple as a place where all peoples can come together to pray. So Jesus is here quoting part of Isaiah that is extremely universalist, that is extremely the opposite of the high degree of nationalism and ethnic exclusiveness that was characteristic of the traditions of Israel. The second allusion in Jesus' teaching is to Jeremiah 7, 7 to 11, and I'll read that for you also. For if you truly amend your ways and your doings, if you truly act justly one with another, if you do not oppress the alien, the orphan, and the widow, or shed innocent blood in this place, and if you do not go after other gods to your own hurt, then I will dwell with you in this place, in the land that I gave of old to your ancestors forever and ever. But here you are, trusting in deceptive words to no avail. Will you steal, murder, commit adultery, swear falsely, make offerings to Baal, and go after other gods that you have not known, and then come and stand before me in this house, which is called by my name, and say, we are safe, only to go on doing all these abominations? Has this house, which is called by my name, become a den of robbers, quote, unquote, in your sight? You know I too am watching, says the Lord. So Jeremiah, in the context of the conflicts that were happening at the time of the destruction of the Solomon's temple by the Babylonians, which was the climax of Israel's resistance to Babylonian domination and conquest, which Jeremiah was advocating, that they would accept that and not go to war. Instead, they did, and Jeremiah is here protesting the degree of corruption that had been characteristic of Israelite worship in the period leading up to the Babylonian conquest and the destruction of the first temple. This phrase, become a den of robbers, is a source of major ambiguity in Mark's story. The word that Mark uses to translate Jeremiah is the Greek word leistes. It has various translations. Robbers, brigands, zealots, insurrectionists, I'm proposing. The reason for this ambiguity is that brigands, which is not a widely used term in English, is perhaps the most accurate term to describe what Jesus is talking about. That is, it's a reference to the bands of revolutionaries in the period leading up to the Jewish-Roman War in 66 to 70, of groups that went through the countryside stealing from the rich and using the money to both give to the poor and to support the revolution. This was, in Mark's context then, in the immediate aftermath of the war, an allusion to what happened to the temple. The temple became the final place of insurrection and of the war. What happened was that in 66, the Romans were driven out. In 68, they came back, reconquered Galilee in 68. In 69, the region of Judea. In 70, Jerusalem. And the bands, the armies, the various armies of the insurrection came together in the temple, and they, as well as thousands of people, families, men, women, and children, and the final siege, they were besieged then in the temple by the Romans for several months. And the temple was a formidable fortress and was not easy to overcome, to conquer. But the Romans succeeded in building siege engines and ramparts and were able finally in August, early August, to break through the walls and enter the temple. So the temple became then a den, a place of warfare, a den of warriors, soldiers, of those who had systematically been engaged in robbery, in brigandage, and most of all, in the insurrection that was the war. So in Mark's context, this was then an exact description. Jesus' words were an exact description of what happened. That is, that the house of prayer, intended to be by Isaiah and major strands of the politics of Israel, a place of reconciliation with the enemy, the enemies of Israel for all the nations, had literally become the final battleground in the war, a den of insurrectionists. The allusions then to Isaiah and Jeremiah were for the original listeners to this story full of implications about both the war and about Jesus' teaching and his potential position as the Messiah of peace, who indicated and taught a way that would have not led to the war, but that was not followed. Now, the reason why the chief priests and scribes sought to destroy Jesus is easily identified in the context of the politics of the period. And of what Mark's listeners would have understood that to be. Namely, that they were pursuing a policy of separation from Gentiles, of nationalism, of ethnic purity, and the idea that there would be gestures of reconciliation, policies of reconciliation and negotiation with Israel's enemies was hated by many in Israel. A similar dynamic has happened in Israel in at the end of the 20th century. One of the leading military figures in Israel's history, Yitzhak Rabin, became prime minister, and he negotiated the Oslo Peace Accords. He was denounced by major groups within Israel. He was vilified as a traitor. And there were conservative rabbis who called for his death. And and it led to one of the students from one of these, one of the teachers assassinating Yitzhak Rabin. The reason why this is helpful is to recognize the degree of hostility and political conflict that is implicit in these words of Jesus and in this story. In Mark, this action on Jesus' part is what sets in motion the plot that ends in his death and crucifixion. The policies in regard to the temple, whether it is an inclusive place or an exclusive place, a universal place of prayer or a place only for prayer by Judeans, those are the issues that are implicit in this. Now, they were afraid of him because the crowd, that is the majority of people, rejoiced at his teaching and were supportive of the policies that he was identifying in his teaching that were implicit then in these words. So the response of the priests and the chief priests and the scribes is a response to a political situation that was generated by Jesus' teaching, in which the people were drawn to and liked the things that he was identifying. And in the context of the first century, and especially in the context of the aftermath of the war, The reason for that was easy for Mark's listeners to identify. Namely, these were policies and ways that had the possibility of peaceful reconciliation with Israel's enemies, rather than the war, which was the greatest catastrophe in the entire history of Israel. So, the implication, finally, at the end of the story, is not that this was a major conflict that went on. Rather, it was a demonstration that Jesus did sometime in the morning, and that he stayed around and taught all day in the temple. What probably happened was that the money changers, you know, set up their tables again, and those who were selling the doves set up their seats, and they continued their business. And Jesus then was teaching during the day, and when it was evening, then he went back out of the city. So this is a brief story of what is portrayed in Mark's overall narrative as an all-day teaching event that was introduced, and for which the first was this demonstration that he did that is being essentially summarized by Mark's story. Implicit in this story is the proclamation of Jesus as the Messiah of peace. It was a demonstration for a place of reconciliation, a place of prayer in which all the nations could pray together in the temple. This would have been a highly positive event that could have led to a much higher degree of reconciliation between Israel and its enemies. Instead, the policy of alienation, of the creation of distance and hostility, led to the war and to the destruction of the temple. So Mark is then announcing and retelling the story of Jesus in the context of the period immediately after the war, 71, 72, 73, and, you know, that whole period of the 70s and 80s after the war, is retelling the story of Jesus as the announcement of Jesus as the Messiah who indicated and charted out policies and ways of being that would have and that still had the promise of leading to peace rather than war. So this is an extremely important story in the Gospel of Mark and in the traditions of the various sectarian groups within Israelite religion in the first century.